Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Hey, really quick before we start the show, the How I Built This book is now a New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestseller. So thank you to all of you who ordered it and for your support of this show. If you haven't picked it up and you want to learn the secrets of how to develop an entrepreneurial mindset, How I Built This, the book is for you. It's now available wherever books are sold and in most countries around the world, or by visiting howibuiltthis.com or guyraz.com. And thanks.
I'm trying to work these different leads on co-founders, and then I had met this kid, Kyle. And so Kyle's like, hey, you should talk to my friend Arash.
And what do you know about Arash at that point?
Virtually nothing.
Just a recommendation from somebody else who's like, hey, this guy, he might be a good co-founder.
Yeah. And he's still in school, right? So we get together in the student center and just start hashing it out. And that was what was so crazy. I was just like, you got to drop out of school to do this.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, I'm expecting to have to talk to the parents and like do all this stuff.
Right.
And he just bounces. A couple days later, he had just dropped out of school.
From NPR, it's How I Built This, a show about innovators, entrepreneurs, idealists, and the stories behind the movements they built. I'm Guy Raz, and on today's show, how Drew Houston came up with the idea for Dropbox on the day he forgot to bring his thumb drive for a weekend in New York, and how that idea grew into a multi-billion dollar business. I probably don't have to explain why walkie-talkies are sold in multiples. Yes, in practice, you could use just one, I suppose, maybe to scan the frequencies or eavesdrop on other two-way radios, or you could just talk into it and hope someone hears you. But that's no fun and not really what these things were designed to do. To get the most out of a walkie-talkie, ideally, you have someone else or even lots of other people talking on the same channel. And this idea is basically what venture capitalists and other investors call the network effect. And in the past few years, products that grow through networks have become extremely attractive to these investors. And why? Because the network effect allows a product to grow on its own without a whole lot of marketing. So here's an example. Someone sends you a survey to complete, and the survey was created using SurveyMonkey. You fill it out and send it back. And by doing that, you have seamlessly become a SurveyMonkey user. And the next time you want to create a survey, you are likely to use SurveyMonkey. It's the same story for Calendly. When someone invites you to schedule a meeting, you get an email from Calendly inviting you to use the service as well. Slack works in a similar way. If one person on a team uses it, the rest of the team will jump on as well. It's a concept called product-led growth. If you use it, your friends have to use it to engage with you. And then you are all users, and the product grows and grows and grows. And this early insight, back in 2006, is what allowed Dropbox to scale into a multi-billion dollar business in a few short years. Because Drew Houston knew that the product he was building would grow organically and exponentially, all at the same time. Because when one person signs up for a Dropbox account and wants to share a file or a document with another person, that second person also has to sign up for a Dropbox account. And most people do because it's free. The vast majority of Dropbox users don't pay a dime for it. Yet the company makes huge profits from the 3 to 5% of its customers who pay, mainly businesses. Now, if you don't already know, Dropbox is basically a hard drive in the cloud, and you can seamlessly access all of your data from any of your devices. And Drew came up with the idea when he took a weekend trip from Boston to New York and forgot to bring his thumb drive. So after mulling over the idea for a few months, Drew decided to apply to the now legendary accelerator program, Y Combinator, or YC. But before that happened, before he grew Dropbox into a company with a $7.5 billion market cap, Drew was, not surprisingly, the kind of kid who was obsessed with computers from a very early age. He grew up in Acton, Massachusetts. It's a suburb outside of Boston. His mom was the school librarian, and his dad was an electrical engineer. And when Drew was just 5 years old, he wrote his first line of code in BASIC.
I dabbled in programming, but then my dad would bring home computer games from work. So these adventure games like King's Quest and things like that.
King's Quest was great.
Yeah. So I played a ton of computer games when I was little, and then was also just interested in figuring out how they worked and making my own computer games.
And I guess like at age 14, you really jumped into computers as a job, like a summer job to work for a gaming company. What's the story?
Yeah, when I was in eighth grade, I think, I'd signed up to test this online game. So I started poking around under the hood of the game, and I found all these security vulnerabilities. And I emailed the developer, really, it was over ICQ. I'm like, hey, you know, you guys need to tighten up a few of these things. And they're like, okay, got it. You're right. Would you like to fix that for us? It was a startup. So they're like, well, we can't really pay you a salary, but we can give you stock options.
Huh. Did they know you were 14, by the way?
Yeah. And then I'm like, yeah, this is all, well, I'm like, is it okay if my dad signs the paperwork? And they were fine with me working remotely and part-time and everything.
Wow. So they gave you equity in the business. And by the way, did that ever, did it ever come to anything?
Absolutely not.
No. Okay. I got you. It's just like, it was basically smoke and dust, right?
Yeah. But it was a great experience. I mean, it was awesome. I was a game developer. This was my dream. I thought that's what I was going to do with my life.
All right. You're working for this company. And you're in high school, and this has become like what you do throughout high school. Like, you're not doing car washes. You're working for this company, or you go work for other companies doing similar things?
Well, it was a really important stepping stone because, you know, my resume before that was babysitting. So having a programming job became a way in to get another programming job at a different startup that was local. So. Yeah. There was this startup called Soft Servo Systems. And what I did there was they were running everything on Windows. I was like, hey, if we can move this stuff over from Windows to Linux, which is free, then you could save even more cost on the hardware. So you know, I'm like figuring out how to move all this stuff. And it was just kind of one interesting project after another.
So you you finished high school and you went to MIT.
Yeah.
And your ambition, from what I gather from this conversation, was to go on and maybe start a gaming company or make games somehow. Is that right?
Well, during high school, as I had these, because I was a literal game developer, but then these other experiences with startups expanded my horizons a lot. And so I'm like, all right, in college, I'm like, I definitely want to do engineering, definitely want to be involved in startups. Mm-hmm. And my first company was an SAT prep company. It's called Accolade.
This is why you were at MIT.
Yeah, I took a leave of absence in the middle of MIT and teamed up with a teacher at my high school who actually had his own little SAT prep business and that he was running out of his living room. You know, the SAT is changing because it went from 1,600 points to 2,400. I'm like, now all of those books, like all that material is now obsolete because the test is new.
Yeah.
And there's not really a great way to do this online. So what if we teamed up and did that? And, you know, we met in a Chili's in Westford and we're, you know, hashing out, trying to figure out how do you incorporate a company and all these. And then that really began the entrepreneurial journey. So I basically took a leave of absence my junior year. It was important that I come back and finish my degree. So I did that. And then I got a job at a network security company called Bit9, which, so anyway, I was working during the day at that startup and I was moonlighting on Accolade, SAT prep startup.
So this is important because you know, you hear a lot of people say, oh, you know, this is my fifth startup or my sixth startup. And I think a lot of people have this idea that, oh, you know, all engines are go and in each startup and you raise a lot of money and you come up with a product, but actually, a startup can just be two people working on their computers, and the business might be a file folder, and that might be the startup.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, is the company still around?
It's not.
It's not. Okay. So did the idea just kind of fizzle out?
Well, we had constraints. So he was not going to leave his teaching job, and neither of us were really ready to kind of throw in completely. And we got it reasonably far along, and we had customers, we had income, we had at least the rudiments of a working product. But I mean, it was a nice, good kind of side income, but it's seasonal, right? So there's only a couple months a year where you're really going, and then it's hard to keep momentum. And so I started getting really distracted. And then another one of my friends, Adam Smith, he runs a company called Kite now. He started a company called Zobni. But he got into YC, and it was just this amazing experience. And I actually...
Because of the support and the resources of Y Combinator.
Yeah. And it just felt like they were just getting to escape velocity a lot faster. Just kind of doing it the right way.
And as the SAT prep idea kind of started to fizzle out, were you thinking about other things you could do? Because it doesn't sound like you really wanted to stay as a programmer or a tech person, software, an engineer for Bit 9. Like, it doesn't sound like that's really what you wanted to do. You were just kind of that you were biding your time earning a paycheck.
Well, I love the work and I was learning a lot. So what ended up happening was with Accolade is I had to work across a bunch of different computers. It was this huge pain to move around. I'd use a thumb drive, but it was slow and I kept almost putting it in the washing machine. But I was really frustrated by that problem. Like, why can't I just have my stuff everywhere?
I read that around this time in 2006, you were taking the bus a lot from Boston to New York.
Yeah.
Why were you doing that?
I had a lot of friends who had moved to New York. You know, every month or two, I'd try to get out there and see them. So I would take the Feng Hua, the Chinatown bus that's now defunct. And so on one of those rides, I was like, I have a few hours each way to get work done. So I'm like, okay, so... And I opened up my laptop as the bus had pulled out of the station. I realized I'd left my thumb drive back at home. And I'm like, now I can't do any... Like, all right, well, I can't get any work done. And then I'm like, well, now what? I'm just sitting there being like, I just never want to have this problem again.
Yeah.
And so I started coding.
You started coding where?
On the bus.
On the bus. Coding code for what?
I'm like, I'm just going to have this thing that like watches this folder and just keeps everything in sync. Didn't have a name.
And by the way, is that easy to do? Like, just for yourself? Is that take like, can you do that on a 3-hour bus ride?
You certainly can't finish it, but you can certainly start. The programming is relatively, it's really easy to make something that kind of works. It's very, very hard to make something that works in a bulletproof way.
Yeah.
And so I just became obsessed with this problem.
All right. So you are, okay, so this is late, I think it's like late 2006.
Yep. It's around Thanksgiving.
Around Thanksgiving, and you start to tinker with this idea, but you're still working, you're still an employee of this cybersecurity company.
Yeah.
And I want to get a sense of where your head was. Were you like, this is it? This is the thing that I am going to do? Or did that, was it a slow burn? Did it take longer for you to get there?
Well, I could feel that sense of liftoff in terms of my passion for what it was, because I'm like, this is totally in my strike zone. I'd love to get into Y Combinator. The next application deadline's in April. But I'm like, you know, this is doable. Like, I could probably find, at least make it exist, and then maybe it's a business, maybe not. But I wasn't really thinking about that. I'm like, I just want to build this thing, and I need it. And if I could just, like, not have to carry my thumb drive around, and I have one customer, me, like, great.
And does it kind of consume you pretty quickly after? Like, do you start to spend nights and weekends just, like, trying to build this thing for yourself?
Oh, yeah. Totally obsessed. And it came together really quickly.
How quickly?
If that was kind of around Thanksgiving, then I had a conversation in January with my boss at Bit9, and I'm like, hey, you know, I'm really going to go for it and start a company and get into Y Combinator. And but it was pretty clear early on that I'm like, yeah, this is going to get going. And I just remember trying to think through the name. This was me. So that... Christmas 2006. Mm-hmm. I'm just on IM with one of my high school buddies, and we would have these LAN parties back in high school, everybody bring their computers to someone's house and you play video games together on a local network. But anyway, so one thing we would always do is everybody would set up a shared folder called a Dropbox on their computer. So I'm like, maybe I should just call it Dropbox. And that was really that IM conversation where I settled on the name and I'm just like Photoshopping the logo.
So the basically the logo for Dropbox today is what you kind of designed and like on your computer?
Yep. And since then, the pros have taken over and simplified it a lot.
Right. Okay. So got a name. And now it's 2007, and you've got a prototype that you kind of like created.
Yeah.
And you had this goal, which was to get into Y Combinator.
Yep.
All right. So what'd you do?
So I started working it. I had so many friends who had, Adam had shipped out to California at this point. And so I'd gotten to know a lot of the other Y Combinator founders socially. So I'd go out and visit them in San Francisco, or I went to like one of the social events at Y Combinator, and I'm literally like walking around this party with my laptop, like trying to demo Dropbox to anyone who will pay attention. But one thing that was very clear from the Y Combinator guidelines is that you need a co-founder. They don't just fund single founder.
They said to you, if you want us to consider you, you need a co-founder.
You need a co-founder.
And this is like Paul Graham's thing. Like Paul Graham is one of the co-founders and partners of the Y Combinator program.
Yes.
I'm like, this is one of his main criteria for investing is a co-founder. Because as anyone who listens to the show knows that, that starting a business can be really tough, right? And there are moments where you want to give up and quit. But but the thinking is that with a co-founder, you kind of increase your chances of not giving up, because when you might be low, the co-founder might be at a different mental or emotional place. And so I'm assuming that's probably why they wanted you to find a partner.
Exactly. So then I'm trying to find a co-founder, you know, if it's March and the application deadline's like April Fool's Day, you know, I've got like a few weeks to get married to someone and I'm not even dating. So I started shaking the trees, but my search hadn't really turned up anyone yet. So my friend Aaron, who's a classmate of mine at MIT, Aaron's like, I love Dropbox. It seems really interesting. If Paul Graham is interested, then I'll do it.
But you needed him to be interested.
Yeah.
And you couldn't wait to be formally admitted to this thing.
No. So I'm like, well, I'm going to drop by the YC office and see what I can do. You know, I'd show up on my laptop, and then I knew Jessica, who was one of the partners. And
you knew her from where?
I had attended a couple Y Combinator dinners and just been kind of in the mix. Mm-hmm. So I was like, hey, Jessica, hey, do you mind if I... Is Paul busy? I just want to show him something. And she's like, oh, no, he's not busy. Yeah, go on in. And so I kind of, you know, take a deep breath and like go walk over and crack the door open a little bit. Like, Paul, hey, you know, I'm really sorry to bother you. So just take a minute. And he cuts me off. He's like, no, I do not want to see your demo. The whole reason we have an application process is so we don't have like random people coming by and pitching us on stuff. So absolutely not. And I'm like, oh my God, because I'm just like total failure.
Well, and you probably, I mean, because you were pretty young at the time, 25 maybe.
24.
Probably thinking, I screwed this up.
Oh, it was a disaster, because I'm like, that failed, and now I've like torpedoed my chances of like getting YC funding at all.
So what happened next? Like, what did you do to like make up for that and eventually get into the program?
So I'm like, all right, well, my application needs a hook. Like, I need some way of kind of standing out. So I thought about what might get Paul's attention. And I figured, like, well, what is he doing in his office then? He's probably doing what I do every day, just like browsing Hacker News and just keep hitting refresh on that.
What's Hacker News for people who don't know?
So Hacker News is basically startup news it's a startup news site, kind of like Reddit.
Yep.
But focused on technology and startups for the most part. So I'm like, I wonder how I could get something on Hacker News that could draw some attention. I'll make a demo video of what I'm doing. And it wasn't just for Paul. It was really just to see if this is a viable concept.
And what was the video? What did it look like?
It was called a screencast. So, which is just to say like it's a video of your screen and then I'm narrating.
Right.
I'm like, here's Dropbox. If you have multiple computers, da, 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 da. And it's very kind of, it's still on YouTube somewhere.
Right.
But I make this 2-3 minute video, stay up all night doing it, you know, the night before the application deadline, finish the application. I'm like, yeah, I don't have a co-founder working on it. We'll hopefully get there before interviews. And then I posted my demo video to Hacker News, and it hit the top of Hacker News for like 2 days.
What was so, I'm just curious, what was the thing about it that was such a big deal among that community? Was it, because there were ways to save information and data in the cloud at that point. Not great stuff, but what was the thing?
Yeah.
Why was there so much interest in this video?
I think it was just kind of getting your files on multiple computers is kind of a niche problem. Like most people had one computer, right? You didn't have a smartphone. But this audience, very technical audience, like they're the early adopters. Virtually all of those people were carrying around a thumb drive. The title of my post, I think, was like Dropbox, throw away your thumb drive.
Yeah.
What goes into a clickbaity title?
And, that's a good title, throw away your thumb drive.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think it made sense. It was just simple. It was in like a lot of that community had struggled with the same problem.
Hmm. All right. So you make this video, you get attention on Hacker News, you put your application in, but you still needed a co-founder.
Yep. And I get a one-line email from Paul Graham.
Yep.
Saying they like the idea, certainly liked your software, but you need a co-founder.
Hmm.
I'm like, thanks, Paul.
Right. Okay. That's good. That's a good
that's
sign.
Progress.
Yep.
And so then I'm trying to work these different leads on co-founders. And then I had met this kid, Kyle, who had been in the Entrepreneurs Club with me at MIT. And so Kyle's like, hey, you should talk to my friend Arash. Arash sent me an email saying, hey, I saw your screencast on Hacker News. Looks pretty interesting.
Hmm.
And he's still in school, right? So we get together in the student center and just start hashing it out.
At MIT?
At MIT.
And what do you know about Arash at that point?
Virtually nothing.
Just a recommendation from somebody else who's like, hey, this guy, he might be a good co-founder.
Yeah.
Like, he's smart, he's a good engineer.
Yeah. And he had been the director of the computer science programming competition at MIT, had been one of the finalists, and I had done that too. So I'm like, okay, that's a pretty good filter. That's a starting filter. And we just hit it off.
Hmm.
I mean, as a practical matter, I'm like, yeah, I need a co-founder. You know, usually these co-founder stories start with like, hey, we're on the same T-ball team,
right.
But definitely not here. And we kind of just went for it. That was what was so crazy. I was just like, you got to drop out of school to do this. And he's like, yeah.
Wait, this was based on one conversation?
No, it was a series of conversations, you know, but not a lot. You know, it was like the equivalent of a few days.
Few days. Okay.
If you're, you know, a few coffee dates, basically.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, I'm expecting to have to talk to the parents and like do all this stuff.
Right.
And he just bounces. A couple days later, he had just dropped out of school.
He just says, all right, I'm good. I'm out.
Yeah. And I'm like, respect. Okay.
All right. So he joins you and Y Combinator gives you the green light. There, you're in.
Yep.
And that comes with a lot of support and introductions, but also $15,000, which
yep.
I imagine was not nothing in 2007, mm-hmm. which got you what? What did $15,000 get you?
Some desktops, some IKEA furniture, a couple months of rent.
Right.
So we get into YC in April, May, and then the summer program for YC is in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
So we spent the summer together. He was living in his dorm. You know, we'd just be in the trenches. Like, we'd wake up at noon. I'd pick him up from his dorm. We'd code till 4 or 5 in the morning.
Eating pizza and stuff like
that.
Do
it again. Yeah. I mean, it was kind of very...
just very... unhealthy.
Yeah. A dorm kind of experience. Yeah. Just the prototypical startup experience. But we were just like working every day coding. But yeah, at Boston, doing Y Combinator, is like we really found our element. There were other like 50 other founders, roughly 20 companies. We really got put on the rails. And then we move out to California together into this, you know, splitting this two bedroom, like kind of corporate, like furnished apartment. Anyway, we finish every company gets, I think we got 7 minutes. They're a lot shorter now. You know, they take a room of investors, they take the companies.
Yeah.
But 7 minutes for our demo. YC ends with demo day, and then all the investor conversations kind of pick up where that leaves off. So we had to go start raising money.
When we come back in just a moment, how Drew and Arash's little business started to attract big attention from some of the biggest tech entrepreneurs in the Valley. And how that attention turned Drew into an enemy of none other than Steve Jobs. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This from NPR. And one more thing, the New York Times best-selling book, How I Built This, is now available. It's a great read and a great gift for anyone looking for ideas, inspiration, wisdom, and encouragement to have the courage to put out an idea into the world. It's filled with tons of stories you haven't heard about how some of the greatest entrepreneurs you know and respect started out at the very bottom. Check out How I Built This, the book. Available wherever you buy your books. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. So it's mid-2007, and Drew and his co-founder Arash finish up at Y Combinator. They're living in San Francisco and gearing up to raise money and trying to figure out how to convince investors that their idea is a risk worth betting on.
When I first talked to investors, particularly in Boston, they were like, no one's really ever made this work before. This is a commodity. Google, Microsoft, you name it, was going to do this and eat our lunch.
And that's what people would say. They'd say, look, these big companies are going to do this. You know, it's just going to make what you're doing irrelevant or obsolete.
Yeah. And I totally agreed. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, obviously.
Hmm. So how did you get beyond that feeling of agreeing with the doubters?
Well, the fact remained, though, that no one had really done this properly. And at this point, you only need one or two investors to really be into it. And so by the time we got to through demo day, we had come up with a pretty compelling pitch.
Can you explain something to me? I don't know if it's possible to explain this in a simple way, but let's try it.
Sure.
The idea here was to enable people to share files seamlessly across their computer, their laptop. And this is when iPhones just started to come out and
yeah. A
smartphone revolution is about to begin. What was so complicated about it? Why was this so hard?
Well, people had bitten off little pieces of the problem, but we were trying to do something bigger. And what was really challenging was how do you basically build a hard drive large enough to be everybody's hard drive? So there's a whole server and infrastructure component of it that's very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
There's a algorithmic component, which is hard, meaning how do you make it so that you can verify the correctness of the system? So how do you design something that doesn't stomp on people's baby photos or, you know, tax returns? Getting under the hood, that's a pretty hard engineering problem. So for a lot of the same kinds of reasons that, you know, a Google search, it's like you type words into a text box and you get links to web pages.
Right.
How hard can it possibly be? It's actually pretty hard. So it's that kind of problem. And then there was a design element of how do you make this really simple and accessible for normal people? And then we wanted to work with all platforms.
And when did you have a beta version ready to go, like that was up and running?
By the fall of 2007, we started opening up the beta a little bit.
And so it's around this time where you start to attract potential investors.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the attention of Sequoia.
Yeah.
Which is a huge deal. And Michael Moritz, I guess, who's a big deal. He's one of their senior partners.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, he comes to your apartment in San Francisco a couple days after you meet him.
Yeah.
Basically wanting to make a deal. Do you remember him arriving at your apartment?
Yeah, it was a whirlwind because we had just had our first meeting with Sequoia on a Friday, and I wasn't super familiar with how these things work. But yeah, Mike, we do the pitch, and then on Saturday morning, yeah, Mike Moritz shows up at our little apartment, Dropbox World HQ, and we walk him through it. Doesn't say a lot, has a couple questions about competition and Google, but then leaves with little fanfare. He's like, come by on Monday to pitch the whole partnership, which is kind of like the final boss.
And during that pitch meeting, Were the partners throwing like tough, skeptical questions, or did it seem like they really wanted to do this?
I'd say they all had kind of a poker face. I think they were interested, but you do your pitch, you leave, you don't get a lot of feedback initially, and then get a happy phone call or a sad phone call. Hmm. And we got a happy phone call saying, hey, come to dinner. We want to hammer this out.
Wow.
And we had a handshake deal that night. So one business day turnaround.
Wow.
Which we were not expecting.
And all of a sudden, you guys have $1 million in the bank to work with.
Yeah.
What were some of the things you did at that point? Like, did you start to hire other engineers? Did you get office space? Or did you just continue, you and Arash, working out of your apartment with that $1 million?
So there was a lot to do. You know, once you have a deal coming, you need a lawyer. Yep. Then you have money in the bank, you need an accountant. Then you have money, you need employees. So we started recruiting the smartest people we knew from MIT as engineers. And so we would do these recruiting trips out there. Arash and I would go meet people in their dorms and pitched our first few engineers that way.
So you start to build it out. And what does that mean? I mean, are you guys, because you and Arash had already been pulling all-nighters for like months and months and months to get to this phase. Now, does it slow down a little bit or does it actually accelerate?
It accelerates because at every point you just have this expanding circle of things you need to take care of because you have, from a product standpoint, you have this prototype, but then you need it to get it ready for prime time. You need users. And so we kept doing all of these unconventional things to try to get attention based on what had already worked before. So the same kind of video that I put together to put on Hacker News, we did another one that was a little more oriented around a broader audience that we put on Reddit and Dig in March 2008. And so we were placing bets on how many people were going to get on here. And I think the high watermark was maybe 10,000 people.
So one of the things that I guess you've said is that Dropbox actually took longer to launch than other startups at the time. Like it took you almost a year from the time that you moved from San Francisco to launching it. Why did it take so long? Why couldn't you just put something out there in like January of 2008 that was good enough?
We knew early on that we would not have a lot of margin for error. And so, you know, move fast and break things was not going to work for us.
Right.
Because once you lose people's trust, it's very hard to get it back. It didn't have to be perfect, but it had to be very good, right? So you can't kind of it's hard to beta test a pacemaker. And we knew that if there's a spectrum from like little website you can kind of throw up in a day to pacemaker, like we were much closer to that end of the continuum.
Right.
And so the other thing is this only became a mainstream need after the iPhone because most people had one computer at home, but then suddenly with a smartphone, everybody's got two. And for the first time, you need to get stuff back and forth very easily. And the only way to do that is through the cloud. Suddenly this went from a problem that the propeller heads had to a problem that every mainstream iPhone user had.
And how did people find out about it?
Well, I had read this book, Crossing the Chasm, which talks about how technology is adopted, starts with early adopters and then moves to kind of an early mainstream and so on. And so this is technology adoption lifecycle. And we're like, we started with the early adopters intentionally. We're like, who are the people that are like actively looking for something like this? They tend to be the kinds of people that hang out on the Y Combinator startup news site or Reddit or sites like that. So we seeded the audience with there. And then it was viral because sharing is a really important part of the Dropbox experience. And then if I share something with you, you have to become a Dropbox user if it's a shared folder. And so the virality was a critical part of our distribution strategy because, and we'd studied that because things like Facebook and Facebook platform were exploding and growing super fast. And it's pretty hard to build a big consumer service without having some kind of viral growth element.
I think, you know, within 2 years or something, you had like 15, 20 million users. It's a huge number of people. Clearly this was resonating. I mean, clearly this was something that was working. I mean, it's kind of crazy. Within 2.5 years, your valuation went up to $4 billion.
Yeah, it was like we were very careful to get the product right through the beta. And then at public launch, we turned on the paid version and we sort of became accidentally cash flow positive after that because it was just growing so quickly.
I mean, this is what's amazing to me is I think by 2011, you had 50 million users.
Yeah.
And your revenue is like almost $250 million. But only 4% of users were paying you. The rest of the 96% were using the free version, which only gave you 2 gigabytes or whatever of storage space. But so all that money was just coming from 4% of the users.
Yeah.
Paying like 10 bucks a month or something.
Yep.
And was that, had you modeled that out? Did you know that that's all you needed? You just needed like a tiny percentage of people to pay?
Yeah. And there was this new business model that had been popularized around then called freemium, where, you know, you start with a free version and then there's a premium version if you need that.
By the way, I should mention, I read that Mark Zuckerberg like sent you a Facebook message in like 2009 saying, hey, I'm interested in learning more about your company. And you thought it was like a prank.
It was wild. I mean, we got on his radar because we were recruiting some of his alumni.
Right.
And, you know, you'd have Facebook open in a tab all day at work and suddenly you're like, wait, what?
So, but was he interested in maybe acquiring you or just wanted to meet?
He was interested potentially in acquiring Dropbox. Hmm. We were still building, so we weren't really interested in that. And then we stayed in touch, and then we became friends.
And I guess also that year in 2009, I read that Apple was interested in Dropbox too.
Yeah.
And that you even had a meeting with Steve Jobs. Is that right? What's the story?
Well, it was surreal. We weren't expecting that. And I was meeting with one of the VPs who reported to Steve, and he's like, Steve would like to meet you. Hmm. And so I was pretty intimidated because then I started talking to my friends and like the stories about Steve meetings were very
scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. This guy said Steve wants to meet with you, not today, but at a future time.
Yeah. He's like, well, we'll get something set up.
Okay.
I'm like, I guess I'm not going to say no. Yeah, sure.
You can't say no. Yeah, it's Steve Jobs.
Yeah. So get there. We're like, we're here to see Steve Jobs. They're like, okay, have a seat. And then Arash and I are like, oh man, maybe he hasn't seen the product. We have to do our kind of get our demo ritual ready. So we're furiously trying to set that up.
Right.
And a few minutes later, Steve comes in. And I think the first thing he said is, you guys have built a great product. So, you know, on my little bucket list under the table, I'm like, okay, check. Good. I guess we might be getting a happy Steve story, not an angry Steve story, but we'll see. And he was basically saying, like, you know, you should really throw in with us because we're like a startup with infinite resources. And
Was it clear to you when you were going to meet him that this is what was going to happen? He was going to make an offer to buy you out?
Probably. I was hoping he wouldn't get into numbers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I thought about goals for the meeting before that. Oh. I was like, what am I trying to accomplish here? I think the primary goal from my meeting with him was just don't piss him off.
Yeah. Did he? So he's telling you all the great things about being part of Apple and And then does he throw out a number?
No. He's like, we'd love for you to really consider this. I think it'd be great. And then, you know, sort of like, I'm like, well, look, we admire everything you and Apple do and have done. Love to find a way to work more closely together for sure. But we want to build this company and think it has a bright future, and that's what we're focused on. Like, I want to stay independent. Like, I'm sure you understand.
And he said, of course I do. I was an entrepreneur myself. Fair enough.
Sort of. He was like, all right, well, in so many words, he's like, well, you guys are a feature, not a product. You know, we're going to have to build our competitor, and I guess we'll have to get to work on, you know, in so many words, killing you guys.
Wait, he was saying to you, hey, if you're not going to work with me, then we're just going to crush you. We're going to build our own thing, and we're just going to take you down.
Yep. And here are your problems. You don't have the operating system. You need, like, partnerships for distribution, like, all these things. And so, because I was, like, in my head disagreeing with a bunch of what he was saying. But, you know, and I'm just like, again, don't piss him off. So I'm just like, all right, agree to disagree. But, yeah, I mean, that part of the conversation was over pretty quickly.
Hmm.
And he just kind of stuck around. He's like, so, you know, where are you guys from? And, you know, he started just talking about the history of sort of the second coming of Apple. And so I think we were lucky in that we got kind of a happy Steve meeting. But he stuck around for another, you know, 30, 40 minutes.
Hmm.
But that was the last time we talked.
Wow. I mean, well, he passed away in 2011. But before he passed away, he did make good on his promise. I think it was his last keynote where he unveiled iCloud.
Yeah.
And he name checks Dropbox.
Yeah.
And you probably saw that keynote.
Oh, yeah. And so did my entire team.
And was your heart pounding watching that keynote?
Yeah, it was. But before that, it was clear that there was definitely kind of a winter is coming reckoning that was going to happen at some point.
For Dropbox.
Yeah. And I would say that from the moment we founded the company, we were kind of always living in the shadow of whatever Google's thing would be or Apple's thing.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and then we'd hear a rumor and the tremors of that would kind of reverberate through our psyche.
You knew that there were a lot of big businesses in the Bay Area that went down, mm-hmm. right? Yahoo,
yep.
Netscape, MySpace. A party you must have been thinking, we're next.
Well, we'd show those like tombstones very literally, you know, on a slide in front of the company.
You communicated this idea to your own employees?
Yeah, because, hey, we need to focus. We need to execute. There are a lot of dead companies that were once great. It wasn't so much about Apple as much as just the whole kind of constellation of competing products. Mm. So we use those moments as a galvanizing force to get us to really focus and execute quickly and motivate the team.
And how would you do that? I mean, I guess one of the ways to make sure that you wouldn't be buried would be to build partnerships, like be everywhere, be the go-to, right?
Yeah. But it was clear that we were going to be moving into at some point there would be a new act. So we were spreading our wings. We started building new products. We acquired a company called Mailbox, built a photo sharing product called Carousel. And I think we were, you know, all that is to say, this was sort of, these were the years where I kind of had to shift from being like a founder to really being a CEO and getting good at the game.
Yeah.
So I remember going home for 4th of July and I reread the book, Only the Paranoid Survive. And so the book talks about this concept of a strategic inflection point where sort of the business is doing well, but things seem off and everybody has this moment where they recognize that things have really changed. So for us, what that meant was we have to really understand what's the value that we're providing to our customers. And our happiest and most profitable customers were using Dropbox at work. And so we decided to go all in on, for all intents and purposes, getting out of the consumer business.
Being focused on business clients?
Yeah, being focused on business clients and just addressing the work use cases. It did mean that a pretty embarrassing moment where I'm like, oh my God, all the stuff that, you know, I was on stage saying is the future of the company, like Carousel and Mailbox and all these other things, like we're just going to have to shoot. I'm going to have to shoot all of them. Hmm.
You're just going to shut these things down to focus on.
I just shut them down. And like so many things that I had proclaimed were the future of the company were like not going to be the future of the company.
I mean, it is amazing that your product was kind of made for these times.
Yeah.
I mean, it's designed for people to share and collaborate and you don't have to be there in person. So I have to imagine you're one of these strange positions where COVID, the pandemic's actually been good for your business.
Yeah, I mean, folks have been turning to Dropbox for distributed work since the beginning. And in fact, I built it not to back up my photos. I built it to be able to work from anywhere. So yeah, there's a through line from the beginning here, but we're thinking about, okay, now we're painting on a much bigger canvas. For example, one of the big problems we all have is just our stuff is everywhere,
yeah.
Right? A lot of our work happens in cloud tools of various forms and our content is scattered in 15 different places. And we live in a world where it's easier to search all of human knowledge than my company's knowledge.
Right.
So there are these big opportunities hidden in plain sight that for reasons that are very similar to like why the problem for Dropbox in the first place was unsolved, like there are huge challenges that are right in front of us. The landscape is always shifting. And so there's always new opportunity.
Let me shift and ask you a more personal question. Your company is now, the market cap is about $8 billion.
Yeah.
And you are, not just on paper, but in reality, a billionaire. What does that mean to you? I mean, does it, like...
It's kind of, it's definitely not what I had in mind when,
right.
You know, when I was at any point in my life.
Well, that's the thing. Most of the people on the show don't set out to become billionaires. They set out to solve a problem. They know they're going to, if it works out, they'll make money. But the problem you want to solve was how to seamlessly integrate files from one treasure the next. But you weren't thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to live in a gilded palace and sit in a vault full of gold coins and throw them up in the air all day.
Yeah, I was always, I just remember early on, the idea of like scaling a company was so scary that on the money front, I was just like, look, as soon as the company's worth $1 million, that would be unbelievable. Then we started getting venture money and things like that. Like, okay, if I have $100 million after taxes, like, then I'm good. I'm done. Beach.
Yep.
Happily ever after. And then in the process of talking to some of our angel investors, you know, one of them had a really successful exit. And he's like, the day I sold the company was like one of the unhappiest days of my life.
Hmm.
And so getting back in touch with like why you do what you do is a really challenging and important conversation to have with yourself. And for me, it was like, I love reverse engineering things. I love building things. I will never get tired of seeing like a Dropbox icon over someone's shoulder in a coffee shop.
Yeah.
I will always look.
Yeah.
You know, I never get tired of that. And so that sense of purpose is really important.
When you think about your story and your success, do you think that it has to do with how hard you worked and your skill and your intelligence? Or do you put more of it in luck? Or what Dropbox folders do you put all those things into?
Well, I think you need both. So I think about it like surfing, like that waves will come. And in our case, like we caught this tidal wave. You know, we're just sort of sitting there on our board and then, oh my God, you know, suddenly we're 50 feet off the ground. But inevitably that wave like slows down and then it's like about catching another one and another one and another one. So I think there's luck in terms of when and how any given wave shows up and where you are on your board. But then there's a lot of skill in staying on and finding the right wave. That matters a lot.
That's Drew Houston, co-founder and CEO of Dropbox. And by the way, remember how in the early days of Dropbox, Drew got a Facebook message from Mark Zuckerberg, who was potentially interested in acquiring the company? Well, while that didn't happen, the two stayed friends, and earlier this year, Drew was invited to become a member of Facebook's board. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the show this week. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can also write to us at hibt@npr.org. And if you want to send a tweet, it's @HowIBuiltThis or @GuyRaz. And my Instagram is @Guy.Raz. Our show was produced this week by Casey Herman with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. Thanks also to Julia Carney, Candace Lim, Neva Grant, Sarah Saracen, and Jeff Rogers. Our intern is Farah Safari. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This. This is NPR. If you like How I Built This, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.